Now, for some of you this morning, when you saw that our reading for today came from the book of Revelation, you instinctively began to look for the exit. Now, others of you may have been very excited, hoping that I was going to explain to you all the intricate symbolism of John's apocalyptic vision of the end of the world in 20 minutes. Others of you have no idea what I'm talking about, but when other people started looking around, you thought something was wrong. Now, I hate to disappoint you today, but none of these reactions are fairly off base, I guess. When we begin to read the book of the Bible, most known as source material for doomsday prophecies and for outlandish theories about the end of the world. And even I am not immune to these associations. I'll never forget when Harold Camping, the late co-founder of the Family Radio Network, announced that the world was going to end on May 21st, 2011, at precisely 6 p.m. Now, this was not the first time Camping had made a prediction about the end of the world. His first famous prediction was that the world would end in September of 1994. Obviously, that did not happen, so he revised his prediction that the world would end on March 31st, 1995. And so, obviously, leading up to this prediction, he did not exactly have the best track record. But that's not why it stuck out to me. What made May 21st at 6 p.m. very personal for me was that that was the exact time and date of Princeton Seminary's graduation that year. Now, I was not graduating from seminary that year, but many of my friends were graduating that year, and I thought to myself, wow, God really doesn't want these people to become preachers. I mean, so much so, we're going to end the world in order to stop them from entering a pulpit. But, as you know, the world did not end, and for better or worse, all those people are now preachers. So, there you have it. I hope none of my friends are watching the live stream right now. Now, I joke, but for many people, the first association they have with Revelation is doomsday prophecies. And this is not a new thing. For centuries, people have used the Bible and other sacred writings of world religions to help provide substance for their end-of-the-world predictions. And for this reason, many Christians today have given up on reading the book of Revelation altogether. But take heart, you're not alone. The church mothers and fathers struggled for a long time as to whether or not this book should be included in the Bible. They were concerned because... And at this point, I should probably ask your forgiveness for using a very technical theological term. They thought it was too weird. Okay? Thank you, choir. Congregation didn't get that. They thought it was weird. So they spent time in conversation with one another. They read it in light of the rest of Scripture. They prayed together. And ultimately, the mothers and fathers of the church felt that this was an important enough writing that it should be included in the Bible. And I hope this morning, at the very least, we can begin to think differently about Revelation as well. I believe that you can't properly read and understand the letter of John without knowing when it was written and why this would have been a timely message for the church. Now, traditionally, church has said that this book was written during the late years of the Roman Emperor Domitian in the late first century. And at that time, Christianity was still an emerging religious movement. There were no church buildings, no sophisticated hierarchies of bishops and priests. The letters that make up the New Testament hadn't even been compiled yet into a single document. For now, Christianity exists as a relational network of people who meet in each other's homes for worship and form small missional communities that go out and serve their cities. Something that you may not know is that at this point in the life of the church, Christians were designated as atheists by the emperor. Now, they were considered atheists because they refused to worship emperors, whether living or dead, as gods. See, in every major city in the Roman Empire, there were temples dedicated to the worship of former emperors. There would be public sacrifices that would be made, big festivals that would happen, holidays would be declared. All the residents of the city, you were expected on these days to come and participate in the worship of the great former emperors. And this was how you expressed your patriotism, your love of country. But for Jews and Christians in the first century, they felt that worshiping an emperor as a god amounted to idolatry. It was a serious offense against God. And for this reason, they became persecuted atheists. The emperor Domitian took action against those in his household and across the empire for their atheism. There were unfair taxes placed upon Jews and Christians, creating this us versus them mentality that led to a wave of sporadic persecutions and harassment. By the second century, Christians were being asked to renounce their faith and make an offering in public to the emperor or face execution. So John, he writes to a young church, still discovering what it means to faithfully follow Jesus, facing incredible pressure and persecution. And it's to these people who are in need of present comfort and future hope that Revelation is dedicated to. So at its heart, Revelation is not a book about God's vindictive judgment against a sinful world. It is a letter of comfort and hope to people struggling to keep the faith in the midst of hardship. His vivid imagery, it paints a picture of the cosmic forces of evil battling the forces of good. And he proudly proclaims the good news that ultimately God will be victorious. A victory that has as much to do with the people of the first century and people today as it has to do with people living at the end of time. See, in talking about the future, John is also talking about today. We can't get so lost in all these provocative images that this book becomes utterly meaningless. Maybe when you're trying to understand prophetic writings in the Bible, it's better to look at prophetic writings today. Those words that have given us comfort in hardship and that have given us a vision for a future. One of the most influential preachers and theologians in my journey of faith has been Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. His writings and sermons, they taught me what it meant to be a preacher. They molded my theological vision. And of his numerous sermons and writings, a few have impacted my life as much as his sermon entitled, I See the Promised Land. For those of you who haven't memorized King's lectionary like I have, this was King's final sermon, and he delivered it on the eve of his assassination on April 3rd, 1968. He had traveled to Memphis, Tennessee to lend support to a group of sanitation workers who were striking, fighting for equal pay and for social justice. And although no one knew it at the time, King would deliver some of his most prophetic words of his entire career. Weary from years of struggle in the civil rights movement, pained by the loss of public support for his opposition to Vietnam, King remarked, "Like anybody, I'd like to live a long life. Longevity has its place, but I'm not concerned about that now. I've seen the promised land. And I might not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. I may not get there with you." How tragically prophetic those words were. But his sermon, it's not stuck with me because of King's timely reflections on life and death at this moment in time. What has forever shaped my understanding of what it means to be a preacher is his encouragement on the need for relevant ministry. Ministry that addresses the real needs of people today and doesn't use theology as an escape hatch from our call to action. I think he reminds us what the book of Revelation is really all about. In his soaring fashion, King says, "It's all right to talk about long white robes over yonder, and all of its symbolism. But ultimately, people want some suits and dresses and shoes to wear down here. It's all right to talk about streets flowing with milk and honey, but God has commanded us to be concerned about the slums down here and his children who can't eat 3 square meals a day. It's all right to talk about the New Jerusalem. But one day, God's preacher must talk about the new New York, the new Atlanta, the new Philadelphia, the new Memphis, Tennessee. This is what we have to do." It's all right for us to place our hope in the fulfillment of God's love for us in the end of time, but the vision of that love should move us to action today. We are called by God to be builders of a just world, founded on those values of justice, love, mercy. Not here today to bide our time until the end of the world when we get those long white robes and walk on streets of gold. We're called to practice love in action. Right here and right now. And so if you only hear King's final sermon as a prophecy of his early death, as an anticipation of the future, and you forget what he was saying to the congregation that night, you've misheard it. Not reading his words correctly. King not only paints a picture of the future, but he calls us to live into it. And this, what I believe John is trying to do in the book of Revelation. You can get so lost in the symbolism, and trying to decipher the codes, that we miss what he is actually doing. John recognizes that the God who is and was and is to come is greater than words can describe. His provocative imagery is meant to help us have a visionary experience of our own. To share in the sense of God's gracious love for all people, despite the challenges that we endure today. It's a collection of images not meant to appeal to our intellect, but to our imaginations, to the poets and artists within us. Which is to say, you shouldn't spend your time reading this work trying to crack a code, but to read it as poetry, trying to stir something up within you, trying to give you a vision of a just world. The God who is named here is the one whose being and actions embrace all time, the God of past and present and future. John writes to a church that is worried about the dangers they are facing and the trouble that lies ahead. They're people filled with doubt and uncertainty. They're not sure of what tomorrow is going to bring for them. And so John reminds these churches that when we gather for worship, we share in Christ's victory over death, a victory that is the bringer of true peace. God has extended grace to everyone. God has created a space where the barriers, the walls that go up between us can be broken down. Can be reconciled together. So the church is to see herself as people living into this new world. Recognize that God is already at work. Bring true justice and reconciliation. This is what it means for Jesus to be the firstborn among the dead. This isn't just an abstract title. John's first listeners. They are people being asked to witness to the power and grace of God in the world, even if it means laying down their lives. And what hope can people have facing such a choice? John says, if Christ is the firstborn among the dead, it is a witness to the reality that there is still a future. Even if it extends beyond the grave. See, resurrection is not some isolated event in the past that we celebrate once a year. It is an event whose power continues to shape history. God is not finished with us yet. John is writing to every person of faith on the journey of life who has ever encountered those forces of evil we believe are anti-life, which you might as well say are anti-Christ, since Christ comes to give us life and life to the full. And to people who are tired and afraid, John offers words of hope. John reminds us that in the face of these dragons and beasts that come our way, no matter what form they take, cancer, death, war, and terrorism, divorce, depression, betrayal, anger, no matter what that monster is looming in your life, it doesn't have the final say. John says that the one who is and was and is to come, the God who embraces all of creation, has the first and final word in our lives. Yes, the book of Revelation talks about the end of history. It talks about the second coming of Christ when God will gather people together to make them one, to build a just and peaceful world. But our hope is not that there's simply a second coming of Christ, but that Christ continues to come to our lives when we are in need. We are filled with sorrow. Struggling to believe that there is life after this moment. No matter what you are going through today, no matter how daunting the challenge is for you, know that God speaks words of healing and hope. And those words determine our lives. In those words, we find ourselves. So our task today to spend time trying to figure out when Christ is coming in the clouds, as John writes, but to learn what it means to live and to love like Jesus today. To not become people so focused on long white robes over yonder that we forget about our neighbors in need among us. Bible presents us with a grand vision of a world in which God's justice, love, and mercy reign supreme. And may we work to make that vision of tomorrow a reality today.